The following podcast is a production of Institutional Real Estate Incorporated. For the most comprehensive industry news and information, visit our website at irei.com and sign up for our free daily news alerts.
This is Mike Consul. I'm joined by my guest, Mike Zlotnick. He is currently CEO of TF Management Group, and he's been a real estate fund manager since 2009. He's a retired software executive and began investing in real estate in 2000. And today, Mr. Zlotnick manages a variety of funds, including the Tempo Growth Fund and the Tempo Opportunity Fund. He happens to be involved in an area that's of interest these days, and that has to do with hotel conversions. When the pandemic hit, obviously certain property types within real estate got slammed particularly hard, and one of them being hotels. And but we have not seen, to my way of thinking anyway, we have not seen the bloodbath a lot of people predicted. Yet nonetheless, there are hotels that are going through these conversion processes. As I say, Mike's been involved in this to some degree and has a good view on this. And before we get into discussion, Mike, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mike, very much for having me. It's my pleasure and a privilege to join your podcast.
And Mike is in Brooklyn, New York, joining us via the internet. So, Mike, let's talk about these hotel conversions. As I was saying, I don't think we've seen the kind of distress or the bloodbath that people thought we were going to see in hotels. Would you agree with that, or do you think it's been much worse than I've characterized it?
You're absolutely right. The bloodbath was never there. We were hopeful. I guess those of us who invest in that sector were hopeful we'd see more and better opportunities. And that bloodbath never happened. And the few of the early deals that we entered were sort of better opportunities. And as the market started to recover, the deal's quality has been slowly eroding. There's still attractive opportunities to invest in, but they look like home runs initially, and then they move to triples, then to doubles, and a lot of them look like singles now. So it's still a good sector, but it's just not as great of opportunities as we were hoping it would be overnight when the COVID hit.
So when there are these hotel conversions, first of all, what is the situation that creates that opportunity? Is it strictly financial distress? Are they out, in some cases, just outdated facilities? And when the conversion takes place, is it all, in every case, is it a hotel being turned into a multifamily development instead, or are there some other uses that they're converted to? Let's start there. What is the conversion? Is it strictly multifamily, or are there like senior living centers or some other uses beyond just housing?
So we've only been investing in hotel to multifamily conversions. I have heard and I've spoken with some folks that were considering convert to a living facility, and I don't know where those projects went. We were not very interested. First of all, they are more they're less of real estate and more operating businesses. So we like multifamily as real estate. The senior living just don't like as much that sector because it's half operating, half real estate. And then the opportunity sort of existed pre-COVID. So let's just start with the basics. The opportunity existed pre-COVID. We had a project we invested in May of 2019. It was a pre-COVID opportunity and actually sold in February 2021. And that project was a home run. It was a great deal. So the opportunity existed pre-COVID. And then what happened during the COVID, a lot of the dysfunctional and weak hotels got hit hard, and they hit financial distress. And that's when they became even more attractive targets for the conversion. So pre-COVID opportunity, COVID created, short-term distress. As the occupancy was very low, and these assets became interesting targets, but over time, as the recovery has taken place, some owners have the opportunity to survive. And then if they choose to go that path, then they can still function as a hotel. So the opportunity pre-COVID, the opportunity accelerated during COVID, and now the opportunity is slowly shrinking. But there are still enough targets where the basic thesis is if you can enter the multifamily complex well below the construction cost, you can enjoy the cap rates of multifamily on the valuation side. And basically just achieve create the product well below the construction cost. On the hotel side, the economics work worse if you can't get to certain occupancy. And some hotels are doing great. Some Airbnb and other vacation spots are just doing phenomenal as people have been getting away from big cities and enjoying those locations. But some other hotels are just not functioning before, and they're not functioning now until, I don't know what will take to get them to back to the hotel operation. So that the primary targets, long-term dysfunctional hotels. That, I would say, is a, regardless of COVID, it's an opportunity to reposition them. So that's kind of the basic thesis.
That's the sweet spot right there. So I want to ask you about why we didn't see the bloodbath that we expected. But before that, how does a guy who was a software executive move into real estate? Why does that happen? And I'll go back even further than that, because you studied mathematics at the State University of New York at Binghamton, my part of the world. And you end up in software, which makes a lot of sense. Why do you make the jump from software to real estate, especially since the margins for software are phenomenal? Of course, you got to put out a piece of software together that sells really well. But it's not a natural leap, I wouldn't say, although your math skills, I'm sure, play very well into real estate deals. How'd that come about, Mike?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's the history question. I appreciate the, I still love software development, still think it's a great field, and I had a great career and really enjoyed working with many great people. I was burned out. I mean, honestly, I started investing in real estate in 2000, again, New York City, pretty much everything buy and hold, not much cash flow, but more of a steady Eddie, pretty good appreciation. And I just realized this is something I like. It's very predictable. It's something I can control the outcome. At least for a number of years, it looked like these properties, at least the stuff that I bought, was appreciating almost a 10% rate in New York. This was kind of a, I don't know how else you put it, but it was, if you are well located near transportation, it was 10% appreciation. So I looked at it and said, this is no brainer. It's got to buy more. And I really like that you can be both active and passive. So I started being a passive investor. And then enjoyed that investment experience with good economics, obviously. And then by 2009, I was a little bit burned out in the software industry. It was a lot of responsibility. A lot of people reported to me, and we call it a. There were a couple of funny jokes here, so let me crack a joke or two here. So first joke in the software industry, because we had to work a lot of hours. And the joke is that most of us are supposed to have the right priorities in life. What does that mean? It means most of us are supposed to put the God first, family second, and then work third. In software, the joke was we pray to God that the family understands that the work comes first.
Okay, so, I get it.
I'm being a little, you know, sarcastic here, but it was burnout, a little tired, a lot of midnight deployments. You can imagine in deploying software that bankers need in the morning. You got to make sure it functions. So that whole industry, as much as it's a great industry, I was burned out personally.
So you burned out, but let's go back to 2000 when you first invested in real estate. Why did you decide to invest in real estate at all? What did you see or what did you hear that made you decide I'm gonna put a foot into this industry?
Well, the first investment, and I don't know how people think about this, but my rule of thumb: your first investment is always your primary residence, right? You buy your home, so you save on the rent payment. So I bought my first apartment, and I thought it was good. I bought it for cash, and I thought, hey, I like where I live. I like the location. It's a good apartment. Can I buy more? And over time, I start picking up more just because it's just, it's...
you saw the appreciation, value appreciation.
And then I realized, hey, I could put a mortgage on the thing and then I can get leverage. And now I can buy another one and can buy another one. And when you start leveraging in a pretty cheap debt, you know, if your rate of the good rule of thumb in real estate is a real simple rule, but this rule works all the time. If the rate of appreciation in a given market, average rate, is above the rate of mortgage that you're paying, you're always going to wind up ahead. So
interesting.
So I mean, it's really basic, but the real estate, it's hard to go wrong in real estate on a long term basis. It's probably most of the wealth has been built in this country through real estate. And that's why, you know, you bite that real estate gold bug and you stick with it because it's fun and it makes good returns.
But there are people who ruin themselves with real estate. They go broke. These are the people who what? They overleverage. Is that the number one cause for basically failing at real estate?
I mean, it depends. But for sure, high leverage works both ways. So if you leverage highly and then you fail in the execution, then you can be wiped out for sure. I see most of the problems happens in the poor execution. So when people invest into projects, they have a lot of faith, belief, optimistic sentiment, and then the projects with substantial value add are hard. It takes time, effort, and experience. And if they fail to execute and you're highly leveraged, you could lose the shirt. So that's that simple.
So one segment of real estate for sure that is beyond just not just the math is hotels, because it's very intensive in terms of operation. If it's not operated properly, you don't have a good staff, it's not marketed properly and so on, it's not going to do well. At some point, you started casting a covetous eye on the hotel segment. Why do you get interested in hotels? Did something just kind of come before your eyes and you saw an opportunity, or was there something more going on that made you think in terms of applying some investment expertise towards hotels?
Well, it's what you said, right? So we were never attracted. We're not much attracted to the real estate that is heavy operating business. Hotels is that. So we're not attracted to the senior living facilities. We're not attracted to the hotels. But as redevelopment, yes, because they build a building or buildings, and it's a lot of cost has already been sunk, but functionally it's not operating the way it's supposed to operate. So if you can acquire it well below reconstruction cost, you're getting into the investment at the right cost basis. And today we're seeing massive cost inflation. Commodity prices are through the roof. Construction materials cost a fortune. Doesn't seem to be an end in sight. So it's even more important to acquire an existing structure with a path to convert to a multifamily. So people need to live somewhere. And generally apartments is your classic real estate, while the hotel is half operating, half real estate. And like you said, it could be hit or miss. And it's very difficult to invest. Please understand, we are capital allocators. We're not active operators. So we invest with operators. So finding high quality operators is hard. And there are a lot of self-claimed gurus and self-claimed masters of it that art, but a lot of them can't function the moment troubles hit. And when the COVID hit, a lot of them just collapsed because they were heavily leveraged, like you said, and it was a difficult hand to play. So investing opportunistically into the hotels, not to operate them as hotels, but to convert them, is what we saw sort of a COVID-created opportunity. As capital allocators, we're trying to shift our resources to the best opportunities as market changes. And this was a change in the market where we saw a ton of opportunity. That's how we basically went into the hotel. And we did have one pre-COVID project, which made sense then, that the story was a better story with a multifamily than a hotel. So the idea existed, and when we saw what was happening, it immediately became, hey, what else can we do in this sector?
So let's say there's a 50-room hotel and it's ripe for conversion, and it's converted to multifamily. Now, obviously, hotel rooms are pretty small. Most hotel rooms are small. So at a 50-room hotel, roughly how many multifamily units would come out of that?
Sure. So it's not necessarily a great example. We don't like very small projects, nor do we like super big projects. I'll use a different examples. And there are a few flavors of the ice cream here. So it's going to be, let's just call them extended stay hotel flavor. And there's going to be hotels that look like motels, sort of Ramadas Inn.
Oh, yeah. So you already have a kitchen area. It's multi-room and you have a kitchen or a kitchenette.
Yeah, exactly. So we just give you examples of some of the projects we invested in. They are Residence Inn, extended stay hotels with a kitchenette built in. There's a living room and there's a bedroom and then there's a small kitchen area. So they look like mini apartments. You don't need to move walls. You don't need to do anything other than just refresh them, fresh up, new appliances, maybe new, paint, new appliances, a few other things, carpet, cabinets, all that stuff.
Oh, wait a minute. Residence Inn is by Marriott.
Yes.
Marriott was not able to keep its facility viable. I mean, why did it end up failing, or did they need to just turn some properties over for some other reason?
Remember, Marriott is a flag, right? They have plenty of properties operated by local franchisees who have local problems. Have nothing to do with Marriott. This has to do with the specific locations that failed, right? So okay. The real estate is all local. Mm-hmm. So we have two projects: one in Winston-Salem, the other one in South Bend, residence and conversions to multifamily. It has nothing to do with Marriott failure. It had to do with local operator not being able to run well. And the location of the assets was good. So if you have for the multifamily conversion. So again, can't generalize it to the flag, can't generalize it to general, city or town. It's very specific. Where is the project? Can it be bought at the right price? And it's at the right location.
It's a local operator, like you're saying. And Marriott will pull its franchise agreement, correct, if things are not being operated to a certain standard and to certain specifications. Is that right?
That's right.
Not necessarily that's was a project you were involved in was that situation, but yeah, it has to be run at a certain level, or Marriott says we're not going to put our name on it.
That's right. That's exactly right. So if these hotels are weak and dysfunctional, they'll lose the Marriott flag. The Marriott doesn't need to have their brand tarnished by a poor operator. So they become natural conversion to multifamily and affordable housing. Generally speaking, they're smaller apartments than your average one or two bedrooms, but you could offer them well below average cost in a given area. That's the reason they're called affordable, is because they are below the average in a given area. So affordability is good for that area. It really depends where it is. And then the second flavor of the ice cream is the, let's just call them hotels that look like motels, like Ramada Inn. You can imagine what it looks like. Mm-hmm. These are studios. I mean, small. They are 250 square feet room, sometimes even less. They're small apartments. They basically are bigger than a college dorm when you share with a roommate. You can have your own privacy. So they work really well when you convert them into a bunch of small studios. For students, they work well for those folks that work very hard, maybe two jobs, and they need a place to crash, but they don't want to, pay for a one-bedroom apartment. They're basically privacy and your own, space, but you don't need a lot of space. Plenty of people who could live in a small place, micro-living sort of concept. So the conversion itself doesn't have to break walls and change from a bunch of hotel rooms into one bedrooms. Sometimes this is part of the plan. More often, they just convert it to studios. And if the location of the hotel is in kind of workforce housing area, then it fits naturally. It's right there where people are looking for affordability. So that's kind of two primary theses. There are other hotels that can be under the conversion idea. Some of the recent investments we've made in the Best Western conversion, another Ramada. And so it's really depends on the location, but I would say that as long as economics and the local dynamics are better for a multifamily there versus a hotel, you know, so it's a plausible project for redevelopment.
You know, I should also mention to our listeners that Mike is a political refugee from the USSR, the former Soviet Union, now an American citizen, and considers himself a patriot. And as I mentioned, he does live in Brooklyn, New York. He's got a wife and four children. It sounds like he's living the American dream with real estate investing and so on. Now, Mike, let's get to that question of the fire sale that never happened. The hotels, there's a lot of distressed debt funds that were you know, sitting on tree branches waiting to start feasting on the carcasses of these dead hotels. It didn't happen. Why didn't it happen? We know that the government offered some support, but was that the extent of it, or were there some other factors at play that kept the hotel industry more secure than people thought it would be?
Right. So U.S. government decided to help. I mean, it was a crisis, and the help was of unprecedented proportions. These loans, the PPP loans, the EIDL loans, specific number of other packages have helped these hotels to stay out of trouble. The fact that the foreclosures were sort of the commercial properties foreclosure moratorium didn't take place, but the banks were strongly encouraged by their regulators not to foreclose and to give borrowers more time to solve the issues. So in essence, the government didn't want to see a substantial recession. And the government, I guess, participation, maybe even interference in the normal distress process has reduced number of these properties that would have otherwise gone through a distress sale. So if you want to blame Uncle Sam, we can blame Uncle Sam that we didn't get enough of these deals. But you know, it is what it is. It's just the opportunity looked great. A lot of money was raised into the distressed investing, and none of this. Well, some of it took place, but not to the degree what everyone hoped. Is that a problem? I would say no. I mean, it's okay. It became, instead of a big volume play, it became an opportunity for a smaller player. So I compare us as a sort of a smaller fund, family of funds, versus the big funds. The big funds had big capital deployment or utilization problem. We didn't. So we were pretty happily finding enough projects on a smaller scale. If you're a big player writing hundreds of billions of dollars of checks, you got a bigger problem because you raised $300 billion, $200 billion, $100 billion, whatever that number, you can't get enough deals in that volume. So the opportunity still existed for small investors, but for big ones, it became much more difficult to find the deal flow.
So pre-COVID, there were hotel conversions going on. Post-COVID, we're not to post-COVID yet, but regardless of the fact that there has not been a fire sale on hotels, is there still going to be, in your eyes, Mike, a future for hotel conversions? Is that simply going to be, because hotels do fail. I mean, in good times and bad, they will fail. Is that going to be a real opportunity going forward, or is it going to be kind of a minor niche type investment for real estate people?
It's still happening. So we have two new projects coming up literally within the next few weeks, a Days Inn conversion. And then another one is a Wingate conversion. It's a Wyndham property. So they're happening still. This thing is not over by any means, but it's a precision surgery, not throwing a bunch of stuff and kind of see what sticks on the wall. So right. It really identification of the right properties, the right locations.
And you have competitors who are also out there looking at these same deals, looking to do hotel conversions.
Yeah. So what I noticed most recently is exactly that. So competition has been getting stiffer. And as a result, some of the target returns on these deals have been, softening. So these numbers are still good, but they're not sort of the home runs we saw earlier. That one hotel conversion I mentioned to you We had a IRR of 73%, which was a home run. The few early investments that we made last year, they look like similar home runs. I don't know if it's going to be 73%. They may be, you know, 40, 50%, but there is a decent possibility. Some of the recent investments, we had targeted returns of 30% IRR. And the few recent ones, the numbers come down into low 20s. They're still decent numbers, just economics are getting not as great with a more competitive environment where people are bidding on these old dysfunctional hotels. And at some point, the sector could overheat and we'll step away. If we can't find good enough deals, that's okay. Let the, I call it dumb and dumber money, the most aggressive money take the risk at that point. But you're right. The competition is coming in and they all want to, you know, they've written the offering memorandums. They've done their marketing. They're talking about the hotel conversions and they're raising capital. And then they need to find deals. And when the deals get tight, people who sit with too much money, you know, money burns hole in the pocket. And I don't want to have that ever. So we're very dynamic. We're monitoring and we can still find decent deals with target returns in the low 20s plus. We'll do it. If the returns start dipping into high teens, we'll probably, you know, step away because it's always this risk. So if you're going to do 10, 20 of them, some will fail. Even a successful operator will run into problems with a conversion. Could it be city delays, construction cost overruns, and whatnot? So as you invest in the sector, you have to assume there's going to be some failure and you have to adjust for risk. That's how mathematics work.
So you also have written a book called How to Choose a Smart Real Estate Investment Fund. Give me and the listeners just some bullet points about, you know, what, when you're looking at investing in a real estate fund, what are the things, maybe tell us about the red flags and then tell us what people should be looking for to make sure they're not throwing good money after bad.
Sure. So thank you for mentioning the book, working on version 2.0 of the book. I'm just going to go through sort of these top 10 questions really, really quickly so people can kind of think about it. So number one question, what's the security of the investment? Just thinking through the process, how much risk are you taking? And do you have a security mechanism or safety mechanism? Two, real basic question, what's the target return on your investment? Obviously, adjusting for risk, important. Is this, what kind of income the investment going to generate and how it's going to get taxed? Is it going to get taxed as ordinary interest rates or ordinary income rates or long-term capital gains? So taxation, obviously. Liquidity of the investment is really important. Some funds are liquid, some illiquid. Knowing what you invest in is very important. Fund fees. So is the fund manager compensated a fair shake or they're making it like a bandit and you as an investor taking all the risk? So the right fee structure with alignment of interest is very important. Frequency of the payments. Some funds pay monthly, some funds pay quarterly, some funds pay upon completion of projects and sale. So knowing that is very important. Obviously, management team experience, deal flow quality, what kind of deals the fund invests in. Are they open-ended or closed-ended? And then overall fund investment strategies, and then have a little bit of a bonus questions on pros and cons of just investing in private funds.
Do you have a preference for open or closed-end? If you were investing in a fund, do you care whether it's open end or closed end?
So it's a great question. It may take a few minutes to discuss pros and cons. As a fund manager, it is definitely easier to operate a closed ended fund. And the big difference is, you know, closed ended fund raises capital for some amount of time and puts the money to work as they raise capital. And they close and then they run their portfolio and then they exit over time and repay investors, get them their pref, their principal, and then, you know, performance split. So closed-ended funds are your classic real estate funds. Open-ended funds, harder to operate because most of open-ended funds have a concept of periodic marking the portfolio to market, mark-to-market concept. So may it be monthly, which is extremely hard to do. May it be quarterly, what we do, and I've seen some people do it annually. So the reason this mark-to-market is important because open-ended funds raise capital on quarterly, periodic basis, say quarterly. And then they redeem units on quarterly basis. So for investors, they can go in and out on quarterly basis. And also distributions typically go out on quarterly basis. So as an investor, now I'm let's just switch the hat. Not a fund manager, I'm an investor. So for some people, being in an open-ended fund is a better investment because of the better liquidity. Generally speaking, there is a lock-in period, but after the lock-in is over, people can start requesting redemption. So there's some level of liquidity, while a closed-ended fund typically has no liquidity until the assets sell. So there are pros and cons. It depends on what investors need. Also, the other key question is really what the fund strategy is. It income focus or growth or a mix? So for income strategies, generally speaking, open-ended funds are easier to implement and execute. So it depends on what the fund invests in. If it's a stable income products, the value is more or less stable, easy to do on a quarterly basis. But if it's a value add, substantial work, very hard to value the assets on a quarterly basis. So that's why different funds match different strategies. And for investors, it really a function, income growth, liquidity, you know, all these questions help folks define what they want. If you don't know where you're going, how are you going to know you got there? Same thing is true for your own goals. Your portfolio needs a certain amount of income, certain amount of growth, depending on your age, your tax efficiency. These questions help think through what is a good match for your own individual strategy. So again, not a CPA, I don't give any advice. Don't play one on TV. Consult with your professional. But planning is just as important as the fund selection. Because if the fund doesn't fit into your plan, you just bought a bright and shiny object, which you now got to figure out where is it in your portfolio and what is it doing for you. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does, Mike. I want to ask you, though, you know, you burned out on software, went to real estate. Do you expect one day to burn out on real estate, or is it not as mentally taxing as software was? Do you see yourself as a real estate investor for the rest of your life, or do you have something kind of next planned?
I appreciate the question. I think this is something I'm really passionate about. I mean, honestly, it was always my calling. So I have to say that when I was working in software industry and I enjoyed that work, my true calling was always real estate. This is something that I enjoy day in and day out. It's not even work for me anymore. It's more like a journey. I'm really, really enjoying what I do. I love doing real estate deals. It's what I do every day. I look at deals. I negotiate deals. I work with operators, with sponsors. We obviously raise capital too, but I'm in my genius zone. I don't know how else to put it. It's just, this is my fun. So I really like the work. It's fun. It's a good living. I have no plans to change, and I don't think I will ever change. On top of all this, real estate has so many benefits that you can't find anywhere else. I mean, you got your depreciation benefits, your leveraged investments where you can get cheap debt. You got your value add forced appreciation. You have a lot of predictability. Yes, there's still risks. None of the stuff is guaranteed, but you could do a much better job predicting the outcome and influencing the outcome, being a good sort of a manager and enjoying the work.
Yeah, and I can hear it in your voice, Mike, and I'm sure our listeners can hear it in your voice that you're definitely enthused about it. You're definitely passionate about what you're doing. Our guest has been Mike Zlotnick, ladies and gentlemen. As I said, he's a former software executive, a real estate fund manager now, and refugee from the former Soviet Union and so on, now living in Brooklyn, New York, living and working in Brooklyn, New York. Mike, I appreciate you taking the time talking about the hotel conversions and real estate in general and some of these other areas. We kind of meandered around a bit, but it was fun to get to know you and understand a little better about what the things that you're doing. And wish you best of luck in the future.
Yeah, thank you kindly, Mike. I really appreciate having me on the podcast. love the journey.